from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we get your thoughts on the public release of the Mueller report. It found insufficient evidence to establish that President Trump and his associates engaged in a criminal conspiracy with Russia, but it details at least 10 instances where the president may have obstructed justice. Trump and his legal team are declaring total victory as Democratic leaders accuse the attorney general of distorting the report and mull their next steps, including impeachment. What do you think of the Mueller report? Tell us next on Forum after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Top Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena this morning for the full, unredacted Mueller report, which found insufficient evidence to establish criminal conspiracy with Russia, but did not make a legal determination on the question of obstruction. In fact, in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's words, quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment," end quote. So what happens now? Joining us to talk that through is Jessica Levinson. She is a professor of law at Loyola Law School. Good morning, Jessica Levinson.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're also joined by Philip Bump. He is a national correspondent for The Washington Post. Good morning, Philip Bump.
Good morning.
And I'd like to start with you, Philip Bump. Congressman Jerry Nadler has now issued the subpoena for the full Mueller report. And we're also hearing that House Democrats are expected to convene a conference call on Monday to talk about their next steps after the Mueller report. We've also heard that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that the conclusions by Attorney General William Barr that Trump did not obstruct justice was directly undercut by the report. So what do you think the Democrats are grappling with right now?
Well, I think there's a tension within the caucus, which we're seeing reflected publicly, which is between some of the more aggressive members, particularly newer members, who want to see a full push for impeachment of President Trump, and leadership like Representative Steny Hoyer and Speaker Pelosi, who are loath to do so for what they see as valid political reasons, including that the 2020 election is looming. I think that part of the reason that Chairman Nadler and others are calling for a full release of the Mueller report is because there is still some gray area about what actually Mueller found, which they're hoping that they might get some more clarity in terms of what actually happened, which might help inform that decision. It's likely, though, given that Speaker Pelosi in particular is reticent to move down the impeachment path, that won't happen, and instead the Democrats will just push forward on the various investigations that exist already in House committees.
Well, Jessica Levinson, do you think there's gray area on whether or not President Trump committed obstruction of justice? You have said that if we were talking about Mr. Trump and not President Trump, we'd be seeing an indictment for obstruction of justice.
That sounds like exactly like something I said yesterday. That's true, and I still believe it. So I think if you look at the report, you know, the headline is enormously helpful for President Trump, and obviously he's going to continue to talk about how there's going to be no indictment for conspiracy, no indictment for obstruction of justice. But if you look at the details of the report, particularly the less redacted portion dealing with obstruction of justice, what you see, I think, is, again, at least 10 instances of possible acts of obstruction of justice. And the facts and the details, to me, indicate that really what was problematic for Robert Mueller, what was between him and an indictment, is the fact that we are, as you said, talking about President Trump, not just Mr. Trump, in part because there's an understanding in the Department of Justice that we don't indict sitting presidents, in part because there was no sit-down interview here. And that was, I think, a result of the fact that we're talking about the president and not Joe Citizen. Normally, when you're talking about obstruction of justice and you want to show corrupt intent, you want to actually sit down with somebody. And also because the president does have broad authority to hire and fire people. So I think that if we were talking about somebody else, given the evidence that's in this report, we absolutely would see an indictment.
And let's look at the evidence quickly. You mentioned at least 10 instances, but which ones really jumped out at you, Jessica Levinson?
I think what really jumped out at me, and I hate to give this answer, is, but one, it's just the breadth of it. It's not just any particular instance, but it's the idea that there was this continuous pattern of behavior with the president essentially asking aides to either violate the law or understanding that they're lying. If you want to look at some of the facts that I thought were particularly problematic, all of the language was conditional here, but a discussion of whether or not he knew that Michael Cohen was providing false testimony, essentially the idea that he might have been not just aware of that, but pushing that. This idea that he was in every way trying to slow down and halt the investigation. You saw these facts with respect to his discussions with Don McGahn, the White House counsel, where he said to him, I want you to fire people. And I think that was, if you want to look at somebody who probably stood in between President Trump and an indictment, I think we're going to have to look at Don McGahn, who really, I think, pulled the president back time and time again.
Philip Bump, do you want to comment on that? But also I want to ask you about something you wrote today, which is in addition to the obstruction instances, you were also quite struck by how Mr. Trump, in your view, was elected with the help of Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I think the points that were just made on obstruction are absolutely right. And I think that, it's important for people to remember the articles of impeachment that were drafted against Nixon, the ones that were actually passed against Clinton, both dealt with obstruction of justice, among other things. And so there certainly is a historical basis for moving forward with impeachment. It's just it's always a political fight. I'm not sure the political will is there by the Democrats at this point. As for Trump and his election, yeah, I mean, he tweeted last night in response to the Mueller report that, among other things, that the votes were not affected by what Russia did. And that's categorically untrue. It is not necessarily the case that Russia went into a county election results page and changed actual vote totals, which is something that was sort of rumored after the election. But it's obviously true that Russia affected the election. Whether or not they threw the election to Trump is a different issue. But obviously they affected the election. There were these two massive dumps of information that were stolen by Russian actors, according to Mueller's indictment and according to the Mueller report. One happened in July, one happened in October. The one in July, people sort of underrate because it wasn't as close to Election Day, but that was focused on dividing the Democratic Party and giving Bernie Sanders supporters a rationale not to support Hillary Clinton, sort of bolstering the sense that Hillary Clinton was like the establishment choice. And that certainly did damage to her in November. And then, of course, in October, we had this release of the email stolen from Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, that basically occupied the first half of the month because WikiLeaks day after day was releasing new material at various successfully squashed the stories about Access Hollywood and about Donald Trump's behavior, if you look at actual cable news coverage, and it had a dramatic effect. Did it win him the election? It's extremely hard to say. There are a lot of factors that came into play. Did it have an effect? Unquestionably.
Well, the other question that I think has been raised is just now that we have this report, how does that reflect on Attorney General William Barr? And Philip Bump, could you first comment on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think Barr has been very effective as a political advocate for President Trump. His initial letter, in which he summarized and then later claimed he wasn't summarizing what it was that Mueller had found, sort of set the table, set the expectation, particularly among Trump's base, of what Mueller actually said. And then, of course, his press conference about an hour before the report came out yesterday morning, which is a sort of a stunning thing to think about in abstract. Normally, the point of a press conference is to answer questions, but people didn't have any questions to ask because they hadn't seen the report yet. It was an odd decision. The fact that he then made various representations of what Mueller had found that were obviously not true based on the report that came out later, including saying that Mueller found no collusion when, in fact, the Mueller report says explicitly we weren't evaluating collusion as a concept because that's not something that has any meaning in law. There were the various ways in which what he said an hour before the report came out contradicted the report, and it makes it hard to assume he was trying to do anything other than shape the political conversation around what the report actually said.
And Jessica Levinson, can you shed some light on this? I mean, in terms of context, like how frequently is this basically unprecedented when it comes to releasing a special counsel report?
Yes, with this caveat that we used to have independent counsels and then we changed the regulations and now we have something that is a slightly different animal, which is a special counsel. And the way that we essentially provide the report to Congress and or the public is slightly different. So I would say it's unprecedented because we just aren't familiar really with special counsels. We're familiar with independent counsels. Now, having used that fairly technical caveat, I would say that I completely agree with what Philip said, and I think that the Attorney General, frankly, was really conducting himself as the President's attorney, not so much as the nation's chief legal counsel, which is what the Attorney General is supposed to be. If you looked at the report, and then if you looked at that four-page summary, I think the most charitable explanation is that it is a highly positive gloss for President Trump on the conclusions of the report. And then I think that there, it really does strain common sense to think that there's any explanation for that press conference other than trying to, for as long as possible, control the narrative of what the report said. And if you look at President Trump's appointments, I think you have to look at Attorney General Barr and think that's an enormously effective appointment for him. I think President Trump said over and over again in public he was disappointed by Jeff Sessions, the former Attorney General. He didn't show him the type of loyalty he thought that he was due and wanted. I think with Attorney General Barr, you're seeing that loyalty. I mean, for weeks, the only thing we had to talk about was that four-page summary, which in many ways, I think, just does not track and is not consistent with the report itself.
And again, Jessica Levinson is professor of law at Loyola Law School. We also have Philip Bump with us, a national correspondent for Washington Post, for the Washington Post. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We're talking about the findings in the Mueller report. And I want to open the phone lines early because I'm sure you have reactions and questions. And we only have Philip Bump for the first half. The number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. We're joined now by Zoe Lofgren. She is the congresswoman representing California's 19th congressional district, which is our South Bay, San Jose, Morgan Hill, and Gilroy. Good morning, Congresswoman Lofgren.
Good morning.
So you've been hearing a little bit about Jessica Levinson's views on William Barr, Attorney General William
Actually,
Barr.
Actually, I didn't. I was working on something else.
But your committee, the Judiciary Committee that you sit on, has called him forward. What do you want to find out from him?
Well, we've got this report. As you know, the chairman has just subpoenaed the entire report, and we want to thoroughly go through it. I mean, not just the facts, but the legal theories, and do our job in a very orderly, methodical way and see where we are at the end of that process.
And you also want to see Robert Mueller. You want Special Counsel Robert Mueller to come before you. What do you want to find out from him?
Well, I think we want to find out from him. Hopefully, we won't have to find out what was redacted from him. We will have received that, but that is one of the options if the Department of Justice resists. I think we'll also want to probe the evidence that we've also asked for, not just the redactions, but the evidence. And some of the conclusions or lack of conclusions reached. For example, you know, the president is fond of saying no collusion, no collusion. There is no such thing in law as collusion. There's conspiracy. And the report found a lot of evidence that there was collaboration between Russians and the Trump campaign, but they did not find evidence, although they pointed out that there had been deletions and lies. They couldn't find the actual precise agreement that they felt necessary to bring a case of conspiracy.
Yes.
So collusion is just cooperation. In a weird way, we found collusion. We just couldn't prove a conspiracy.
Okay. In addition to that, the report also has quite a breadth of detail, as Jessica Levinson said, of an effort by the president to thwart the investigation by Robert Mueller into Russia's election interference. Do you think these are grounds for impeachment?
Well, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves with that. We're going to go through and completely explore the report, including the parts of the report that have not yet been shared with us, and then we'll see where we stand. I'm, I think, the only member of Congress who's worked not only on the Clinton impeachment as a member of the Judiciary Committee, but when I worked for Congressman Don Edwards, who was a member of the Judiciary Committee, I worked on the Nixon impeachment. And I'm aware that the process of impeachment is not just a legalistic issue, it's also a political matter. where the will of the American people to deal with a problematic president is exercised through the process of impeachment. I don't know that the country is there at this point, and we may never be there. There's another issue, which is how long this will take and the proximity to the next election, because the primary way we choose our presidents is through elections, and that's proper.
What do you mean by the country is there? Because whether the country is there or not, if you let the president off the hook for behavior that clearly suggests obstruction of justice, are you setting a dangerous precedent?
Well, you know, when it came to the Clinton impeachment, there was an impeachment and an acquittal in the Senate, and I think there was fair evidence that he obstructed because he lied under oath, but it had nothing to do with the government. He lied about sex. This is a very different matter. It appears to be obstruction relative to an investigation of his collaboration or his campaign's collaboration with the Russian government. That's a serious matter. It may not be that the only remedy is impeachment. It may be that the best remedy is for the American people to act. It may be one of the things we talked about during the Clinton impeachment was a matter of censure as opposed to impeachment. All of those things, I'm sure, will be discussed. But the point I'm trying to make is impeachment is undoing an election. I mean, we can talk about holding the president accountable in many ways, but impeachment undoes the election, and that is about the most severe thing you can do, and it can only be done in the most extreme situations. And as I say, it's not just a matter for the Congress. It is a judgment that is reached by the American people as well. If we were to impeach on a partisan basis, I don't know that that would achieve the goals of those who are actually urging an impeachment inquiry, because it has to be a matter that where the government acts to protect itself. We're in a process that will lead us to a conclusion of whether or not that is an appropriate action. And I don't think we can leap to the end of that conclusion, that process at this moment.
U.S. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, I know you needed to leave us at 9:20. I appreciate you staying a couple minutes longer. Thanks for joining Forum this morning.
No problem.
And I've invited listeners to join the conversation, so let me start with Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I remember when Bill Clinton ran, he had a banner across the trailer, and to keep them focused, and the banner still said, "It's the economy, stupid." And I don't know why the Democrats running now don't adopt a common theme, which is, "It's the Russians, stupid." We should start really focusing on the fact that that President Trump was collaborating with Russia during the campaign is astounding.
Peter, thank you.
And why can't we just focus on that?
Let me get Philip Bump's thoughts on that. First of all, What is the Democratic Party saying around Russia? What are the candidates potentially saying? Because Peter feels like they're certainly not bringing this up to the degree that they should. And honestly, Philip Bump, how much are Republicans talking about the Russian influence on the election?
Right. So the Democratic candidates for the 2020 primary nomination are not talking about this a lot. And from what I hear and what I've observed, voters aren't asking them about it very much. And I think that it's important to remember that from the standpoint of a candidate, the people who are most outraged by Donald Trump on this issue don't need to be convinced to vote against Donald Trump. So if you're running against Donald Trump and you have to spend time talking to voters about something, you're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the thing that people are super agitated and very eager to vote against Donald Trump for. You're going to talk about things which may convince people who aren't as excited about voting against Donald Trump and try and make the case to them. Quite frankly, the mantra that they're taking is something more along the lines of, "It's the economy, stupid," right? In this case, it's healthcare, stupid. That's the sort of thing that is driving a lot of these campaigns right now. I get that it may be good for fundraising and things like that to talk about Russia. But from a standpoint of winning over votes, those votes are pretty much already in the bank. As for Republicans, Republicans have not talked about this much at all. A lot of Republican voices that are talking about the Mueller report in particular are saying, that's it, it's done. Donald Trump is exonerated. Let's move on, sort of echoing what the president himself is saying. There's not a whole lot of benefit for them to talk much about this either.
Well, let me go next to Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to preface my comments with maybe this is too much of a legal question, which unfortunately I think is one of the reasons a lot of this gets lost on the public because they want quick answers. But still, on this issue of what I'll call attempted collusion or corrupt intent and the decision not to push forward with interviewing the president to determine corrupt attempt, the discussion seems to have been framed on the president's aides didn't succeed in they didn't carry out the requests of the president, and therefore, you know, he's not, you know, sufficient. There's not sufficient evidence of him obstructing the justice. My question is does that, should, as a legal matter, does it make a difference whether they succeeded or not?
That's a great.
Shouldn't it be based on what, if there was a corrupt intent on the attempt, then it's obstruction. But if there's not a corrupt intent, not just an intent, but a corrupt intent, then there is an obstruction. So if one of your
Neil, that's a great question. And, you know, this does seem to be the line, Jessica Levinson, that, look, this investigation was able to proceed. So regardless of, for one example of the obstruction instances or something that could be perceived as obstruction, is the fact that he wanted to fire Robert Mueller and do other things to thwart the investigation. The investigation ran its course.
It did, but I think your caller has zeroed in on something really important, which a number of Democratic representatives, for instance, I saw, you know, Ted Lieu talking about this and tweeting about this yesterday, which is obstruction of justice includes an attempt to influence an ongoing proceeding.
Yes, and, but does it require success?
It does not require success. What it does require is when you're attempting that you have a corrupt intent. And I think that while there was a lot of language in the report about this idea that the staff was sort of pulling the president back, what you have here, I really think, is a situation that hinges on we couldn't fill out the contours of whether or not the president forms that corrupt intent. And it's for the reasons that we talked about a few minutes ago, which is there was no sit-down interview with the president. And I think when people look back at the Mueller report and when they really analyze what Robert Mueller did, whether or not he did a good job, which I think under the circumstances, frankly, I think he did an extraordinary job, the question I think people will come back to is why didn't he subpoena the president for live testimony?
Yes. I mean, do you think Mueller got played here? I mean, they agreed to do written answers, took a long time to get those answers to him so that by the time he felt they were unsatisfactory and could subpoena the president, he felt it was too late. It would be too close, possibly, to the election. And we just have 10 seconds. Jessica Levinson.
Short version, no, but I'm not sure that decision will stand the test of time.
Well, we'll have more about the Mueller report after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Justice Department released the redacted version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russia's election interference. In the aftermath, President Trump's legal team has declared total victory, while Democratic leaders see a roadmap for further investigation. We're talking with Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, Philip Bump, national correspondent with The Washington Post, and we're joined now also by Katie Benner. She's a Justice Department reporter at The New York Times. Good morning, Katie Benner.
Hey, hello.
Thanks for being with us. I also want to thank our listeners. And if you have questions, the number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum. And you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Katie Benner, I know you cover the Justice Department. We've talked a little bit about William Barr's presentation of the Mueller report before releasing it yesterday. You've also made note of how the White House was given a copy of the report hours before he made that presentation. Can you talk about why that's notable? And can you tell us whether that's appropriate?
Sure. So, you know, in Bill Barr's world, it is completely appropriate because you have to understand that he, when he's the Attorney General under George Bush and today, he has a very extreme view on the power of the president. He believes as the head of the executive branch, the president directs the executive branch, and the president has complete authority over it. And he stands outside of mainstream conservative thought on this because his ideas are a little bit extreme. So if his boss, the president, asks to see a report that is the work product of the Department of Justice the president oversees, for Bill Barr, that is a completely appropriate thing to do. So that is certainly his point of view. Now, in doing so, the argument was that he was giving the White House extra time to prepare a response to this report, which in many places is completely devastating to the president. But because the report is so long and so thorough, it was difficult for anyone to completely prepare a full-throated rebuttal to every single allegation in this document.
Well, let me go next to listener David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi. I think something we have to consider really deeply in all of this is this long-term strength of our institutions and the balance of power between Congress and the executive. And I think we all know that impeachment is a political process, but it sounds like, especially with the Congresswoman's comments earlier, the decision of whether to pursue it is being driven by the political considerations rather than the facts of the matter. And I think that does enormous long-term institutional damage because a future president can look, even with opposition party in control of the House, can say, well, as long as conviction is difficult, or as long as it's perceived that there's a political penalty for pursuing impeachment, I have carte blanche to obstruct justice with, frankly, obvious facts of the matter, as long as the politics are aligned. But I think at some point we have to consider what is the long-term message if we don't even pursue hearings over impeachment with facts of the matter that are frankly obvious.
Well, David, thanks for that comment. I want to go to this listener tweet, which is, discuss how William Barr should be infuriated that the Department of Justice and FBI participated in a Banana Republic-style coup. Philip Bump, I want to first get your reaction to this because I know you have to leave us in a few minutes. Ultimately, is Barr angling to investigate the investigators? He's already sort of suggested that with his spying comments. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly has hinted at that. There was a fascinating moment yesterday after his press conference in which Catherine Herridge from Fox News asked him a question about that. Well, is there anything in this report about how this got started? And he sort of put her off. That today's not the day for that. He didn't say we're going to get to that. He just sort of said that's not what today is about. But there certainly is this implication, in part because this has been driven by Donald Trump and driven by his supporters, this focus on how did this thing get started? Was there, to use a phrase that's come up a lot, was there corrupt intent in how this investigation got started? Now, that argument and this overarching coup narrative, which is just essentially nonsensical, all of that hinges from the fact that President Trump and his supporters were looking for a rationale to dismiss the Russia investigation at the outset. Mm-hmm. So they sort of worked backwards and found evidence showing, for example, these two FBI employees, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who'd had these text messages showing that they didn't particularly like Donald Trump. They played a role in the Mueller investigation until they were fired from the team. They sort of constructed this narrative. It was all based on the Steele dossier, yada, 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 which, quite frankly, the Mueller report itself does a great deal to undermine. There's no mention of the Steele dossier. In fact, what Mueller does is he outlines the rationale for the investigation being the fact that he had folks like Paul Manafort and Carter Page who had existing known questionable relationships with Russians who suddenly joined the Trump team. You had this guy, George Papadopoulos, who said this thing to the Australian diplomat, this story people have heard 1,000 times before. There is a narrative that is being promoted by President Trump and his supporters to suggest that this whole thing was fraught. And, you know, perhaps there were some dereliction in terms of actual processes that were used at the FBI or, you know, some minor things that's being looked at by the inspector general. But there's no sense that this was driven as part of a political motive. And I think it is sort of fascinating to watch what will happen next from the standpoint of, is this something that actually gets pursued?
Yes. And it sounds like you're saying you believe even if it does get pursued that nothing will necessarily come of it, but that it could be just enough to sow doubt in people's minds that the report is legitimate, or at least, yes.
Well, so essentially, I mean, I think that already exists. Yeah, I think that already exists, and I think it'd be interesting to see what Attorney General Barr, if he's presented with stuff that he can use as an argument in Donald Trump's support on the president's behalf, if he actually uses it on President Trump's behalf, as he seemed eager to do yesterday morning.
And before you leave us, Philip Bump, are there any key things that you are watching for that you want to highlight for our listeners as, the aftermath of this report's release is now upon us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's going to be a new focus on some of the questions that still remain unanswered. There are significant questions. One of the things that I think is that people are sort of missing is that Robert Mueller and his team in the report itself articulate, we were not able to answer some of these questions because we couldn't actually track down answers to them, that we weren't able to contact people or people lied to us or we weren't able to subpoena X, Y, and Z, including the president. That investigation wasn't actually complete in certain areas, I think, is going to give Democrats and give opponents of President Trump an opportunity to move forward with their own investigations that could reveal more. I mean, I think that there still are some threads, both on obstruction and on coordination with Russia, that remain to be explored and we could learn more about over the next coming months.
Yes, we've certainly seen that the Mueller report mentions several, maybe even more than a dozen criminal referrals. How many of those do we really know about, I think? It's unclear. I think you're right that, yes, we will be learning a lot more, but it may take a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, those criminal referrals are going to be a big deal potentially, not necessarily focusing on President Trump, but certainly fleshing out the picture more. We can guess who some of them are. There was this conservative writer, Jerome Corsi, who'd worked with Roger Stone, a longtime associate of President Trump's, who had offered a plea deal last year, and nothing came of that. It seems quite possible that he is subject of one of those criminal referrals, and he made all sorts of allegations, including that Roger Stone had told him on October 7th, the day of the Access Hollywood tape, to try and get WikiLeaks to dump all the Podesta emails. Now, Mueller found that that wasn't the case, that Corsi didn't actually, that may not have actually been a true statement by Corsi, but there are all these other threads that we still don't know the answers to that we may learn soon.
Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Really appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And we still have Katie Benner with us, Justice Department reporter at The New York Times, Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, and we have Garrett from Oakland. Hi, Garrett. What's on your mind?
Yes, I think the obstruction of justice is sort of overrated. And I think it's not appropriate for the Congress to investigate what's not a high crime or misdemeanor. And you have to think in context that usually, for example, I'm an attorney, and a lot of judges say that there's perjury in almost every serious trial, and yet nobody ever gets prosecuted for perjury. It's very rare because it doesn't have an effect usually. And obviously, if there was some obstruction of justice, it didn't stop the investigation. It didn't significantly or even noticeably interfere with the findings. And it's not a severe kind of obstruction like telling somebody directly to flee or to hide or to lie. I mean, he told people he wanted them to be loyal. He wanted to fire people, which is in his power. I just don't see that this rises to the level that we should waste the country's energy and even think about. The oversight of the government is for two things, either to impeach someone or to do good legislation. We're not going to get any better legislation. They know enough now if they want to make a harder, stronger statute for the obstruction of justice. So I'm just saying, let's move on. Let's do the work of government.
Well, let me get Jessica Levinson's response to your point. Jessica Levinson, your thoughts.
Well, we know that impeachment does include obstruction of justice because, as we talked about earlier, all you have to do is look to President Nixon, where the articles of impeachment were drawn up and they include obstruction of justice, and President Clinton, who was actually impeached, although he wasn't convicted in the Senate, and the articles of impeachment included obstruction of justice. I would also say that obstruction of justice, it is difficult to prove. It should be difficult to prove. But I do not think that we should narrow obstruction of justice to the point where it just includes essentially statements of you should really flee the country because you're going to be charged. One other thing I would say that the caller, who obviously is a very educated person and a lawyer, picked up on is this idea, well, the president has the power to hire and fire people, and presumably so he has the power to potentially to fire James Comey. And this was the argument that Attorney General Barr made when he wrote this 19-page memo essentially to the president saying, I don't think Robert Mueller has a good theory for obstruction of justice. And I would say to your listeners, think about it this way. Almost everybody owns a laptop. You have the power over what you want to do with that laptop. If you want to set it on fire, go ahead and set it on fire. But if you know that the FBI wants information on that laptop, now you don't have the normal control and power that you usually do. Now, if you set that laptop on fire, it's destruction of evidence and or potentially obstruction of justice. So I think that we do need to keep clear that while the president has broad authority and discretion in terms of personnel, many other issues, it's not unfettered. You still cannot use that authority corruptly. You still cannot use that authority to commit a crime.
Well, thank you, Garrett, for the question. Speaking of intent, though, Attorney General William Barr did give a version of what he felt was the motivation of President Trump, and we have some tape. I want to play that, and I want to get, Katie Benner, your reaction to it.
There is substantial evidence to show that the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents and fueled by illegal leaks.
Katie Benner, what's your reaction to Attorney General William Barr giving that explanation?
I think it's a really carefully worded statement because he's speaking from the point of view of Donald Trump's beliefs and his fears and his worries rather than the point of view of the facts that are in this report. So if your goal is to be on national television where your boss is going to see you and say something that will make him happy, William Barr has done a very good job. Critics, both current and former Justice Department employees and officials, have called me very upset about this statement because they feel that it's the job of law enforcement to hew very closely to the facts rather than to do something like get into the mind of the sitting president and sort of talk about how his emotions and feelings played out in the course of a two-year investigation. But again, I think that what Bill Barr was trying to do was to connect with the White House.
Do you think that he is accurate in his description? Because I ask because, of course, there's that well-known line that was included in the Mueller report where when President Trump was told about the investigation that he declared at the end of his presidency that he was effed, for lack of a better word, which leads one to believe that there were other things on his mind.
Yes, of course. And again, like, this is Bill Barr channeling the emotions of Donald Trump in a really truncated way. I think that it's pretty clear from the report. Again, if you look at the report and the facts, it runs counter to some of the representations that Mr. Barr made in his press conference yesterday, certainly.
Well, Ben writes, I'm concerned that the confusing rhetoric around obstruction of justice will hide the main issue, that Russia influenced our election and the Trump administration has done absolutely nothing to stop that from happening. Katie Benner, your thoughts on that? We did talk to Philip Bump about how quiet it feels like Republicans have been on this question of on all of the evidence in the report showing how Trump associates cozied up to or were comfortable with help from the Russian government, but didn't necessarily cross the line that would establish a crime in a court's mind.
You know, I think that we've seen this be a very norm-shattering presidency and campaign in many ways. Certainly in past campaigns with other candidates, both Republican and Democrat, you can imagine a world where those overtures from a foreign power would be met with a quick referral over to the FBI and no contact. So that was highly, highly unusual. I don't know that we would see that again. I think the larger point about losing sight of the crime that the special counsel's office did clearly identify, Russian election interference, I do think the Justice Department is focused on that. I do think that Bill Barr has made statements saying he doesn't want to see that happen again. And certainly one of the biggest things to come out of this report and this investigation was the way that the public view of huge technology companies like Facebook and YouTube has changed utterly and completely. Before the 2016 election and under the Obama administration, those companies were hugely, wildly popular with consumers and with politicians. Politicians could not cozy up to Silicon Valley fast enough, actually the Obama administration. You saw officials leave this administration after Trump won and all got jobs in communications and operations and high-level senior positions at the very Silicon Valley companies that were now wondering, hey, did you help destroy democracy? So that switch in view on those companies has also changed, and that's a consumer issue. And so to the extent that consumers are now extremely aware of how they can be manipulated, that should sort of help us in, as we go into the next election. But as we saw from this report to the listener's point, this is a huge and ongoing issue that is not going to stop just because we now know Russia did it. Other countries will try to do it, and Russia most certainly will try again.
Yes, it's been described as a blueprint for other countries to take on. Let me go next to Ali in San Francisco.
Hi, Nina. I have a question I'd like to your listeners and your guests to think about. What would happen if we had a democratic president who was helped by an adversary state like Iran? What would the public reaction and the constituents of the Republicans would think about, you know, here we have a democratic president who an adversary state like Iran helped elect? That's the question I'd like to pose.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Jessica Levinson?
Well, my thought is that, unfortunately, in America in 2019, almost everything is viewed with a partisan lens. And what Robert Mueller gave us really is a legal document, and I think it changed absolutely zero minds. I mean, in terms of, you talked a little bit with Philip Bump about, you know, what will this mean for politics, for Democrats going forward? I think anybody who actually is following the coverage of the Mueller report, reading the Mueller report, already knows how they're going to vote in 2020. And so I would say, you know, to your caller's hypothetical, unfortunately, my instinct is that it would depend, basically everybody's responses would depend on whether or not they're a registered R or a registered D.
Well, Katie Benner, we're hearing that, and you can tell me if this is still the case. I don't know if there's been some even more recent polling on this, but that even after William Barr's summary of the Mueller report, that there wasn't necessarily a significant uptick in the president's approval ratings as well.
Sure. I agree that this report for most people is not going to change minds, especially politically. To the extent that Republicans dislike President Trump or don't think he does a good job on many fronts, you have to understand he has completely delivered for the party, the larger, you know, the larger Republican Party. He has given them conservative judges. He has given them two Supreme Court seats. He has given them laws that they love. He's given them a hardline stance on immigration. So whether or not you like President Trump and whether or not you think that he is a good president, if you're a Republican, he has delivered for you in myriad ways. So one of the things I find interesting about a lot of the callers and a lot of the comments I've heard today and yesterday and even before is this idea of how do we oversee the White House? There is a law right now of swirl and spotlight being put on Congress. But when you look at, you know, the writings of the founders and you look at the Constitution, we're ultimately the way that we bring oversight to the White House is through the general election. And so, you know, we can fight about whether or not Congress should impeach Trump based on these findings. But it really does make me wonder, will this fuel people and get them to the polls? Because ultimately that is where the true oversight is.
Well, let me read at least a comment from Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, so that people have a sense of what his reaction is. It is time to move on. He says Americans deserve better than this partisan quest to vilify a political opponent. And I urge our Democratic colleagues in the House to put their emotions and opinions aside and instead use that passion to come to the table and work on real solutions for all Americans. Let me go next to Amy in Mill Valley. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to say?
A couple things. I was just listening to you talk about changing, you know, the hearts and minds of Trump supporters, which was something that I was, you know, interested in hearing your opinions about. But not just all Trump supporters. What about the Trump supporters who swung the election, who just couldn't suck it up to vote for Hillary? And then the other comment I had was, I am in favor of impeachment proceedings at this point. I've been reluctant to say that until this time, but I think it's going to be the only way that the Congress will ever see the full unredacted report and underlying documents so that they can actually make a decision as to, you know, how far did this really go? Because, I mean, it's clear the president's intent was to obstruct justice. It's just because of the people around him that he didn't.
Well, Amy,
and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Amy. And before I ask Katie Benner to weigh in, Kenny tweets, have we become a get-away-with-what-you-can culture, one that even a lot of Trump's opposition is ambivalent about? If so, and Congress fails to act, will the next election be democracy or just a popularity contest? Katie Benner, Amy mentioned that she's in favor of impeachment, but she also asked the question about the swing voters, I guess, to some extent, and whether this is having any effect on them. I don't know if you have any insight on that.
You know, I don't know if this is having an effect on swing voters, frankly, and I hesitate to get into the minds of voters in April of 2019 for something that we're going to engage in more than a year from now. A lot can happen between now and then, between this report and when we go to the polls. I do think that it's interesting that Congress is being asked to take on some sort of action. I do think that we have become really detached from politics as Americans. I think we've lost a lot of faith in politics as Americans. So a lot of the things that are happening right now, whether it's evaluating the performance of William Barr, whether it's evaluating the performance of the legislative branch, whether it's reading this report and looking at sort of the chaos inside of the White House and evaluating whether or not these folks are doing a good or bad job, we are being invited to, in this moment, really put pressure on our elected leaders and our officials and hold them to a higher standard should we decide that we want to do that as the American public. And it's something that we feel like we've been a little bit detached from for a while.
Well, let me go next to Shabazz in Oakland. Hi, Shabazz. You're on.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of questions. Number one is, you know, they talk about a sitting president cannot be indicted because he has to run the country. My question is this. Supposing he was incapacitated in some other way or he passed away, then that's the job of the vice president to take over in his absence. So what's the argument behind him not being able to be put in prison if he violates the law? No one should be above the law.
Shabazz,
and the second part,
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
And the second part of my question is, shouldn't there be, can't Congress pass a law that would hold people like William Barr in check when it's obvious that they represent the president as opposed to representing the country, which is what they're supposed to be doing?
Shabazz.
And Congress should be able to pass a law that would keep them in check.
Thanks. I think it's a high bar, no pun intended, with a divided Congress. But on the question of why can't you indict a sitting president, Jessica Levinson, I mean, that's been talked about quite a bit as this, not on this show, but just in general. And so Shabazz's question, I think, is definitely getting at an unsettled issue.
Absolutely. So I think in many ways, and I keep thinking back to this as we've discussed a number of different issues regarding the Mueller report, in many ways I think this presidency has really been a stress test on our institutions. There's been a lot of legal assumptions that haven't been tested before. And one of them, for instance, can you subpoena a sitting president in this situation? Can you indict a sitting president? And particularly when it comes to indictment, I think what's most important for people to remember is there's nothing in the Constitution that says you cannot indict a sitting president. This is really just an understanding by the Department of Justice. There are memos from the Office of Legal Counsel that say, in part what your caller said, which is that we're worried that the president then would not be able to run the country if he was facing an indictment and had to defend against an indictment. The other things we're worried about are potential separation of powers issues in terms of whether or not you should be able to do that to the chief executive. But I would say that I think there's a lot of things that we're now looking at and saying, did our assumption hold true or not? And I would actually have kind of a similar comment to the second question about can't Congress pass a law that would essentially rein in Attorney General Barr? And I think that the answer is we have previously understood that we should give not just the president, but also the attorney general, broad discretion and broad authority. If you listen to interviews by the people who wrote the regulations creating the special counsel, the hope and understanding and, frankly, assumption behind all the regulations is that the attorney general would conduct him or herself in a fair and honest way and would understand that their constitutional duty is to represent the American public. And the question, I think, for us going forward is, do we want to create changes? Do we want to limit the power of the presidency, limit the power of the attorney general, based on what's happening in the Trump administration? Those are systemic changes, and they would be with us for every administration going forward.
Well, Stefan writes, or Stefan, can we indict Trump after he leaves the White House? There's been much made of Mueller even planting those seeds. Jessica Levinson.
Yes, we can. So this is just about not indicting a sitting president, with this caveat that there are still statutes of limitations. Now, there have been critics of President Trump who have said he's just going to run for office for a second term because he wants to run out the clock on certain potential crimes. The statute of limitations for the federal crime of obstruction of justice is 5 years. Mm. And so obviously if he were to serve a second term, when he's no longer sitting president, the statute of limitations would have run on that particular crime.
Well, Jessica Levinson, we will have to leave it there. Jessica Levinson is a professor of law at Loyola Law School. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It was a great hour. Thank you.
And also Katie Benner, Justice Department reporter at the New York Times. Really appreciate your analysis as well.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions and your comments and reactions. Still lots to digest, and we appreciate hearing from you. I'm Mina Kim. You've been listening to Forum. Another hour is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.